I think musicians should learn from actors and theater people sometimes, like, because I think they seem to have a better attitude about this. You know, it's like, I think if an actor screws up a line, they still keep their character going, you know, they still stay in the scene. They'll improvise a line that's sort of like what they were trying to say, because the important thing is that they keep the scene going. I don't think that actors necessarily say the lines the same way every time, you know, and even though they're saying the same words. I think that's how we should approach it a little bit more. Yeah. And I don't think we were really taught to do that.
Welcome to the Self-Defined Human podcast. I'm Michael Corman. This is a podcast about meditation, radical acceptance, music, art, and videos. Today, I'll be talking with David Service. David is a piano teacher, and we met on Instagram towards the beginning of the 2020 pandemic, and we both make videos. So we're going to talk about that, and we'll talk about piano practice, piano teaching, meditation. We'll talk about theoretical computer science, because why not? So let's get started. Hi, David. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Michael. Nice to see you. Nice to see you in person.
Yeah, I know.
Sort of in person.
Sort of in person, yeah. We're kind of far away, I guess, but this is in person for these COVID times, I guess, anyway.
This is about as close as you get to in person these days, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
If you're interacting with somebody in real time, then I think that kind of counts as in person. Mm-hmm. If it's not like I write you a note and then you write me back, you know, a day later, and then I write you back a day later, then it's in person.
That's close enough, I guess.
Yeah.
So we have been interacting on Instagram for a number of months. This whole pandemic, I guess, really is kind of probably about when we met. And so how did we meet? It was I think on a Facebook piano teacher group, I think, somehow.
Yeah, I think so. Although I don't think I really knew who you were. I think the first time I noticed that you were a person was on Instagram. And then I looked back and I was like, oh, I've interacted with this person before. But I didn't really, I think it was actually just starting to watch your random talking videos that I started to actually like know who you were. And then I looked back and said, I've talked to this person, but it was just a name before. So,
right.
So I don't really think of it as, I feel like I really met you right around the start of the pandemic when I started kind of interacting with you.
You've been posting random talking videos on Instagram. This is something I started doing around the same time. You've been doing it. And it's been interesting to watch what you've been doing, because, you know, for me anyway, this is kind of a creative outlet of some kind that, you know, I started doing it for music. I was trying to teach music things on Instagram and, well, on my website too. And I was trying to learn about marketing. Mm. And this kind of branched out into something else too.
Yeah.
And I see you're going down that path as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, you started posting the random talking videos before I did, and I think I saw your very first one, at least the one that's on the Instagram account you're using before, unless you did it somewhere else. And I just kind of like didn't pay a lot of attention to it, but I just noticed it. I was like, it's kind of interesting, just like a 1 minute video, just, and I didn't even notice that there was a thing. I just noticed doing more and more of those, and just seeing them kind of seeing your videos evolve from like the first ones were kind of, I don't know, just kind of, you seem kind of reserved and kind of really like a serious person. And I don't know. And then they just kind of like changed it to something totally different. And I started to get really like hooked on. I like couldn't wait for the next random talking video to come out, because like, what's he going to do next? Because I started getting like weirder and more interesting and more like unexpected things. So at some point, you had said, okay, because I was posting videos of piano playing. I started out just posting videos of playing those Bach chorales. In fact, my account used to be called Bach Chorales Are Cool. And then I changed it because I started posting videos of juggling. And you said, I think you should post a tutorial of how to juggle. And so I did that, and I felt kind of funny about it, but I was like, oh, okay, that sounds kind of fun. And anyway, so I started kind of following, I think you said you should post a random talking video, or I think maybe you kind of encouraged me somehow, either directly or just by watching you do it. But then I started doing it. So I was like, I started, I don't know, probably like 3 or 4 or 5 months after you did, but it was definitely from watching you that kind of, I just said, I kind of want to go through that transformation too, I think.
Yeah. It's been cool to watch what you've been doing, because, you know, you've been, yeah, the juggling, that was cool. I mean, you know, I don't know how to juggle, so that was cool to watch somebody do it and kind of talk about it. And you've been doing other stuff too, like these interviews you've been doing. You've been just interviewing like everybody that you can get your hands on, right?
I still want to do that. I haven't done that for a couple of weeks, but yeah, I was just binge interviewing people, just like doing not quite like this, but just short 15-minute interviews, and just like anybody who, but the only criteria was that you were, I said I was going to try to make them about musicians, people who do music. And so and you know, so I got a lot of students, people that have been my students in the past, but that was cool. And then a couple other people that I work with, and then a few people. Yeah. But it was kind of an extension of the random talking videos, because it's the same sort of thing. Like, you don't script what you're going to say. You just, I never planned any of those questions. I just started asking people stuff I was curious about. It was a nice excuse to just like pick people's brain. I mean, I love to do that. So.
Right. Yeah, you know, this isn't scripted. I don't know what I'm talking about here. I mean, I sent you a short list of topics to discuss today. I don't know if you wanted to talk about anything else. We were going to talk about, it was about the videos. It was about meditation, about piano teaching, piano practice. I think that might have been the whole list.
Yeah, that was a pretty good list. I feel like we could probably talk about all that stuff for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah.
6 hours or so.
6 hours. Let's do it.
Okay.
I hope the listeners are ready for this.
Yeah, but get comfortable, everyone.
Right. Videos, like for me, this is a type of practice. It's something that it's a form of meditation for me. It's just like piano practice. Like, I don't see the difference between piano practice and making videos. It's like you sit down or whatever, you're, you know, maybe standing up, but you're just turning the camera on, you just go for it, and whatever happens, happens. And maybe there's some idea about what I want to talk about that, you know, usually I have some concept of it. Sometimes I don't, but sometimes I do have a concept, and it's like, it's a skill that I'm trying to get better at, just like practicing the piano.
Mm.
Do you see it that way?
Yeah. I was kind of thinking about that. I mean, for me, it's kind of a skill. Part of the skill is like figuring out what my thoughts actually are, like trying to get my thoughts together. But there's also the skill of just speaking, you know, like trying to speak clearly and communicate clearly. So it doesn't even matter what you're communicating. I kind of feel like I've been trying to get better at that, and these have helped. So it almost doesn't matter. I could say anything about anything, but I just want to speak in a way that's easy to understand. Because one thing I don't know, I like, I've noticed when I watch my own, and is that I, you know, sometimes I can't even follow my own thoughts. I'm like, what is this guy talking about? It's me. and I think, you know, we're it's hard. Most people probably aren't really aware of how they come across to other people. And how could you be? Because you're inside your own head. But if you watch yourself on video, I feel like you're getting a little bit closer to like, am I actually communicating in a way that people understand or not?
Right. I know. I remember it was really awkward at first for me. I didn't want to make videos because I'm not comfortable seeing myself on camera. Certainly wasn't at the time. That was really awkward. I mean, I was comfortable writing, but talking, speaking, video, no. And that was a big challenge for me at first. And watching the videos was a challenge. But eventually, you know, eventually I kind of got used to it. I mean, I still don't love to look at myself, but sometimes it's fun. And that's the same thing with piano too, like recording myself.
Mm.
That's awkward and has always been. And I know tons of people just avoid it. They don't do it at all.
Yeah. You know, it's weird though. It's like, I think a lot of people would say the same thing. Like, I don't want to see myself on camera, but when I see you on camera, doesn't seem like there's anything wrong with it to me. That's just, this is a person. That's what this person looks like. That's what their voice sounds like. There's nothing like bad about it. And, but I think it's kind of strange how, I don't know if it's because it's just not what we expected or if we have a different, if it just doesn't match the image that we had of ourselves, and so we see it, mm-hmm. It makes us, like, why do you think it makes you uncomfortable to watch yourself on video? Do you think you're ugly or something, or?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It's just this, it's all these little things like that. And, you know, there's something that's also a phenomenon, and depending on how the camera's set up, like if the camera is mirrored, like, because we're used to looking at ourselves in the mirror, which is, now if you're using like selfie camera, like, mm-hmm. then maybe it does that too. It looks like a mirror. Okay. Mm-hmm. But if it's a normal camera where it is not like a mirror, so it's, it reverses the picture. That is very, very strange. And I didn't even realize that until, I don't know, maybe a year ago. I didn't even know that was a thing.
Yeah. Cause Zoom does that. Zoom will flip it for you sometimes, I think. And, I remember if I look at my own image, I'll all of a sudden get confused because I put my hand up here like this, and then I see the person on the screen do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like right now, I don't know how it is for you, but right now it's like a mirror for me. So I'm raising my left hand and the left part of the image shows it.
That's how it is for me too, but sometimes it isn't. I'm not really sure why it switched. I'm sure there's a box that is checked somewhere. I have never looked at it, but
But if it is the reverse, if it is not mirrored, then it, like, that's uncomfortable to look at because that's not how we're used to seeing ourselves.
Yeah, but that's probably how everybody else sees us, isn't it?
That's how everyone else sees us.
Yeah. And nobody else is weirded out by seeing, like, people that you know in real life. When they see you on video, I'm sure they're like, well, that's Michael.
Yeah, that's Michael.
That's him. That's the guy.
Nope. I know. But we have these concepts, I think, of how we look and how we're supposed to look. And, you know, we don't spend all day staring at ourselves. So we're just kind of like, we have this mental image of how we look when we do things. And that image probably doesn't correspond to reality, doesn't correspond to what other people are seeing.
Mm.
But also, you know, the camera is not really reality either for a variety of reasons. The way that the image is distorted based on the lens is, like, that's on a camera is fixed, but in real life, like, it kind of moves around, and so your brain kind of puts it together. But other people are used to looking at us on video, and they're used, you know, they don't care as much what we look like as we do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, just in general, people don't care about us as much as we care about ourselves. They're not thinking about us, you know, because I remember at some point I was posting, I haven't done this for a while, but I was posting compositions. I was like, I'm going to write a 1 minute piece. Like, I wrote a one or two minute lullaby one time and a waltz, and just like, because I've always been kind of, you know, same as like the random talking videos, like, kind of afraid to post music that I've composed because I think it sucks, or I think it's good at first, and then after I spend some time with it, I don't like it anymore, and I don't want I'm embarrassed for it to be heard. But I just kind of forced myself to put those things up, and the thing is, nobody cares about it. I mean, people might listen to it once if I'm lucky, or if they might even listen to 10 seconds, they're like, oh, nice piece, whatever. But in my mind, I'm like, oh, they're gonna think I'm such a cheesy composer, or, you know, but people don't care about yeah, people are wrapped up in themselves. So that should be comforting, maybe.
Do you think that Instagram is like, because to me, like when I was learning to play the piano, this was not a possibility. Okay. There was no social media of any kind. So,
right.
You know, I couldn't post anything like that. But now, and that's what I started doing when I started really posting on Instagram at the beginning of this year, 2020, some of the first videos that I did were piano improvisations. And I was like, people are going to love this, because, you know, who wouldn't want to watch piano improv? It seems like a cool thing to say.
Yeah.
I guess some people do, but I didn't realize this could be a good practice too for me to just put stuff out there like that as a way. It's kind of like a performance that, you know, maybe some people see it, maybe they don't see it, but it's like, if I were starting to learn the piano today, I would do that. I would do it every day. I would post something like that.
Mm. Do you think it's important to post it, or would it be enough just to record it and watch it yourself? Do you think it's important? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's something about posting it that's like, you're kind of putting it out there and you're kind of making it, you're kind of saying like, well, this is something I'm doing. Like this is, you're committing to it in some sense. Like it's an act of kind of accepting it of what you're doing and just, because if you don't post anything, then, I mean, it's kind of like you're hiding from it. You're not willing to really own it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I think that's important for musicians to own what they're doing.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because I mean, if you're by not posting it, you're kind of, I guess the only reason you wouldn't post it is because you're afraid that people see it and think it's not good. I mean, that's the main reason you wouldn't post it, right?
I mean, I think so. I mean, unless, you know, maybe you just, there's only so many hours in the day, but
yeah, I guess.
If I suggest to you, you know, post your video, you know, post your playing. I mean, why not? Why not?
Yeah. That would, and I think, I don't know about you, but if I'm afraid of something, and then I don't do it, then it just makes me more afraid of it. You know, like if I'm afraid to have a difficult conversation, and so I just avoid the conversation, then I'm going to keep avoiding it. You know,
yeah.
And if you're afraid to play, if you're afraid to screw up in front of people, then that fear is only going to grow if you don't just face that fear.
Right. Because if you avoid it, like what you're doing is you're rewarding the fear. So you're saying, oh, I'm afraid. Okay, great. I don't have to do it. And so now the next time the fear is going to come back stronger, because it knows that it's going to get that reward of being able to just step back and relax.
Yeah. So this year I started teaching a lot more piano. I was teaching a lot of group piano and RL skills. But one of the teachers at the place I work is retiring. And so I'm getting a bunch more students and which I used to have more anyway, that doesn't matter, but I'm doing a lot of teaching and I've been making my students record themselves a lot.
Nice.
And, I don't know how they feel about it. I think they think it's okay. But for the past few weeks, I'm like, every week, let's record ourselves, because we have the studio class and we just do it all over Zoom. Let's record ourselves and watch it. Record ourselves, watch it. And I make them record themselves. I say, it doesn't matter if it's not perfect. We all understand that it's a work in progress. This is not for your CD that you're going to publish, or you're not going to put it on Spotify. This is just for learning purposes. And I don't know. When I do that, I feel like even if I don't do anything specific, if I just record myself, watch it, listen to it, and then do it again, just repeat that. I did this just the other day. The improvements happen. You know, it improves without me really even having to intervene much more than just like, because you're just aware of what you're doing. And I feel like it's sort of the same with the random talking videos. You know, you just watch it, and then I see, oh, I hesitate a lot when I speak, or I have a lot of filler stuff when I speak, or I stutter. I don't look at the camera, and I just notice that I don't, and then it just gets better.
Yeah, I've noticed this too. It's like there's a feedback loop that happens where when you allow yourself to take in that input, allow yourself to take in what you're putting out, then you just, you know, because your mind knows, like, you know what is good and what's bad. And as you do it, it's like if you allow yourself to generate that loop and to evaluate your own work, then there's this auto correction that tends to happen.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping is happening with my students. And I think it is. I feel like without much intervention from me, just having them record. I mean, of course, I intervene a little bit because we do have lessons. But, you know, just the act of them recording seems to make a difference, I think. Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if it's making a big difference. Yeah. You posted a video the other day about how teaching, you can't teach. I forget how you phrased it, but something about how there's piano teachers don't do anything. You can't teach piano. Do you know what video I'm talking about?
Yeah. I think I was saying, I know exactly what you're talking about. I can't remember quite how I phrased it either, but I think the idea behind it was that, most of the actual learning, maybe of anything, happens. The student does all the work. You know, the teacher, like, I'm not really teaching you something. I'm not saying, here's some stuff I know, and now I'm giving it to you. You have to learn those things on your own. And this is how I've seen teaching for a long time. Actually, it's like I think my job is really as a teacher is just to kind of create the environment where students can learn. You know, like, for example, we're going to have class and you're going to have to play for each other every week. And then it's not that I don't give any suggestions, but I think that ultimately they're going to have to learn from their own self-discovery. That's why I've seen it that way for a long time. And I was happy to find out that that's that other people see it that way too. Cause I thought I just know from my own experience, like, somebody will be trying to teach me something. I remember my undergraduate teacher trying to tell me some things about technique. And then maybe 5 years later, I would discover something, be like, oh, that's what he was trying to show me. And it's not that it took me 5 years to understand it. I think it's just that I discovered it on my own, and then I figured out what he was trying to get me to discover at that point. Do you see it that way? Do you think I'm close to right? Or
yeah, I think we're on the same page with that. Like, it's the experiences. This is how I tend to phrase it: is that the experiences are your teacher. Like, that's where you learn, is by doing things and by, you know, it's not necessarily even a conscious process. Like, things happen. You take in information, you learn what works and what doesn't, and that's how you learn. And the teacher's job, I mean, if anything, is just to sort of set up the conditions, somehow encourage you to go into those situations where you will have those learning experiences. I mean, you know, recording is a good example of that. Like just by listening to your own recording, by watching your own videos, you will, like, that's your teacher, you know? Mm-hmm. But music teachers, it's like, and I love to pick on music teachers. It's not just music teachers that do this, but I want to pick on them because, you know, that's
go for it. Me too.
Yeah. Why not?
Yeah.
Like this is such a common thing in music teaching is it's like the teacher's job is to verbally correct your mistakes, to tell you what you're doing wrong, as if that's gonna teach you anything. But, like, you know, the way I've always felt it as a student, and I don't think I was aware of this at first as a student. It took me a long time to become aware of this. Mm. But for me, there's always this sense of, like, well, yeah, I know I'm doing it wrong. Like, you don't have to tell me it's wrong. Like,
right.
That's not what I need.
Yeah. You don't need to tell somebody to say you missed a note there. Yeah. I was there, you know, I was there when it happened. Yeah. No, I know what you mean. And I think, you know, I think that's when you're a teacher, I think you have to realize that's not helpful for the student. In fact, it can actually be kind of harmful because it's like, you know, it's in a way, it's a punishment to the student for making a mistake. And the last thing that you can do is play at being afraid of making mistakes. I mean, I think that's going to make you play worse. At least it makes me play worse. If I'm afraid, if I make a mistake, it's all over. I've been lucky. I haven't had teachers that are really like, you made a mistake, you played a wrong note there. I haven't really had a teacher like that, luckily, but I know they're out there. But I have that I've had for a long term, you know. I played for a choir director one time. Every time I would make a mistake, he would stop, be like, oh, let's do that again. I need you to be more accurate there, or something like that. It's really annoying. And I just played worse. I played worse and I played worse. And it's like, that's not, you know, you shouldn't focus on the mistakes, I don't think, if you're a teacher. But a lot of them do it. I mean, because they don't know what else to do.
I think that's what it is. I mean, do you think that there's any merit in this? Because sometimes I wonder, like, maybe some people just have a different personality. Like, personally, yeah. When somebody points out my mistakes, I play worse because I'm not focused on my playing. I'm focused on them. And but I wonder, you know, maybe there are teachers out there, they have a different personality, you know, maybe, you know, trying really hard to not make a mistake. Maybe it makes them play better. Do you think that's possible? I mean, some of them seem so confident about it.
I think some students, here's the deal. It's like, like I said, I think I was lucky because I had teachers. Like, my undergraduate teacher was all about, you know, like, let's shape the phrases. Let's get the right character. If you miss a few notes, that's not the most important thing. And I think that was good for me. And because it helped me focus on those things, like the bigger picture things. And then later on, I actually did have a teacher who started to be a little bit more like, let's try to play perfectly. Let's try not to make mistakes. But it was, I think a teacher has to have an instinct about what the student needs at the time. The thing is, I was ignoring a lot of my mistakes, I think, later in life. I was just like, whatever, nobody cares about that. And, it's not that nobody cares about that. And so it was like, in a way, the teacher has to have an instinct of like, this student is not really aware that they're even making mistakes. So I need to point that out. It's like, you know, can you play that without missing any notes? But most students are pretty aware of their mistakes, I think. So it's just I think that's kind of the art of teaching, is you have to figure out what the student needs at the time that's going to help them be better. And if a student isn't aware they're making mistakes, my favorite way to point that out is to have them record themselves. Once they record themselves, then they can hear. I don't have to say, oh, you missed a note there, or you missed five notes. And I don't want to say that to them because I don't want to make them super self-conscious about it. But if they record themselves, then I hope that they'll correct it without me putting a lot of guilt or shame on them. That's what I don't want to do.
With me personally, I don't remember a time, like maybe when I was first starting, I would play a wrong note without knowing it was wrong. But I mean, very early on, like that was, there was never a wrong note unless I really read it wrong somehow. Like I just misread what was there, but almost like, it's hard for me to imagine how somebody could be playing the piano and not know that they played a wrong note. Like that's really hard for me to imagine. And I have to think that a lot of students are just maybe not comfortable admitting it or talking about it. Because here's the thing, is that there's sometimes I have this idea that a teacher, like if somebody's making a mistake, there's like, if they're not correcting it themselves, and if they're not aware of it, then I have to wonder, is this a mistake that they're ready to correct? You know, if it's not part of their consciousness, like that this is a mistake, that this is even a mistake, then like what's going on there? Like it to me, it's like, it probably means that they're not at that level where they are able to perceive that kind of detail.
That's interesting. I'm not sure that could be the case. That, you know, if they don't hear it, then, but yeah, I guess if you're a teacher, one of the things you might want to do is try to help expand their awareness a little bit, you know, by pointing it out. But I hear what you're saying. You know, it's like, it could be that, you know, if they're making a lot of mistakes, if they're making a ton of mistakes, or if they're not hearing obvious mistakes, then maybe it's because like you said, maybe they're not ready to fix that mistake. Maybe they're busy just trying to figure out, something. Maybe they must not be paying attention to that thing.
Let me give more specific example, because if we're just talking about wrong notes, like, that's one thing. Okay.
Right.
Like, it's kind of hinges on the definition of mistake here. Like, I think about singers a lot. Like, if you're singing in a foreign language that you don't speak, okay. Mm. And so you could talk, like, if I'm singing a song in German and I don't speak German, we could talk about the rules of pronunciation in the German language.
Mm.
And we could write those down. You could write a whole book on it. And you could list, you know, 500 rules that I need to memorize.
Mm.
If I'm singing the song and the teacher might be correcting my mistakes in my pronunciation.
Yeah.
But I don't speak the language. So it's like, am I ready for that level of detail? Because maybe I'm singing the right notes. You know, maybe I have the words basically correct. Like, that's the level that I'm at. You know, even though for a native German speaker, or even somebody who's not a native speaker, that the errors that I'm making might be very elementary. But for me, that's like, that's somewhere that I'm not, like, I don't have access to that level yet because I haven't spent any time with the language.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably true, because I think, you know, if you coming at it from that angle, like talking about a singer pronouncing the words correctly, if you're just going through and saying, oh, instead of making this sound, you need to make this other sound, that's really just, isn't that really just imitating what, that's not really singing the song. That's with an understanding of what, that's just like trying to pretend like you speak German when you really don't.
Right. And it's like, yeah. So the teacher could correct those mistakes, but like, it's good. It's kind of almost a monumental task for me to try to assimilate all those corrections, because like, the teacher is not correcting it because they have a list of rules they memorize. They're correcting it because they have some exposure to the language and they kind of have an intuition about what's right and what's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, that intuition to me is what we're talking about here, like, rather than just memorizing rules.
Well, that kind of comes up, that intuition that comes up for me in just teaching piano, because a lot of times, you know, I'll make suggestions to a student, like what you can do with this phrase or what you can do with this section, and it's based on exactly that, like an intuition. And it always occurs to me, it's like, what are they supposed to do with this suggestion? I mean, it might give them an idea of how they might play this phrase in a way that makes David happy. But why? How did I know that they should do that? Or what gave me? Where did I come up with that? And I came up with that probably because something to do with the music, something to do with the harmony or the melody or the dissonance or the structure of the phrase or. The structure of the whole piece, or something, you know. And so it's like, that's what students need to learn. They don't need to learn how to play this piece. You know, if I could get a student to play exactly a piece exactly the way I want them to play it. But I think that's worthless really to them, other than they can play one piece and I can probably get them to play one piece and sound good, but then they go to another piece and they can't transfer it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's those fundamental things are what you're talking about. I think intuition, understanding harmony, and things like that, or understanding dissonance, or understanding structure. If students understand those things, then they'll have their own intuition. Hopefully, that's what I hope anyway.
Right. It's like I love this idea of teachers not being able to teach things, because I paid so much attention to my own learning. And two things that you said there. One about like harmony. Okay. So when I have heard musicians talk about how they want to get better at harmony. They want to understand harmony better.
Yeah.
So that they can, you know, maybe they can play better. Maybe they can sight read better. Maybe they can whatever. And so what they do is they learn, you know, they get a book on music theory or they take music theory classes, and that's fine. Okay. There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
But to me, the beat, like, how do you know how to interpret a piece of music? Like, yeah, based on the harmony. Okay. So look, since the time that we were all little kids, okay, watching Sesame Street or whatever, we have heard harmony. And we have, like, this has been, like, hammered into our brains over and over again. Like, we have this intuition. Everybody knows about dominant and tonic and all that. Like, we all know this. There's nobody in Western society who is not an expert on these concepts. But even if they might not have the vocabulary for it, but we all have that intuition.
Totally.
Like, that's the thing. Like, students need to trust that. Like, they need to trust the, like, what they know to sound right, what they know to, like, just the energy and the flow of a phrase. Like, speaking, we do the same thing. The speaking, like, we know where a phrase in our voice, where it will rise and where it will fall, you know, when we speed up and slow down. That's all stuff, we know all of that. But piano students don't trust it. And I think it's, you know, I think it's because the teachers teach them not to trust it.
Yeah, we piano teachers teach them not to, that their instincts are wrong sometimes. And the thing is, sometimes their instincts might, I shouldn't say that they're wrong, but sometimes their instincts might not be very good. But I think there's a great danger in teaching them to ignore their own instincts. I think it's better if they, you know, if they say, oh, I kind of feel it this way, to let them do that rather than teach them, oh no, you can't trust your own thoughts. You need to listen to me. I think that's, you know, I sort of dealt with that, especially after I got out of school. I realized, oh, nobody's telling me how to play this piece now. Can I play a piece? Do I have to go to be coached by somebody before I should perform it? At some point, don't I mean, I'm not saying that that's not valuable, but I'm just saying, like, at some point I have to become the authority, because I'm not taking lessons anymore. I'm not saying that you shouldn't, but it would probably be, it's not a bad idea to go and be coached, but yeah, you have to learn how to trust yourself. I'm not going to take lessons every week, anymore. I just did that for a long time, decades, you know? Maybe I wouldn't have had to take lessons for as long as if I had learned how to trust some of my own instincts earlier. And I don't think the teachers, I mean, I'm not quite willing to say that the teachers are evil, you know, but I think that's, because I think they don't know what they're doing. I think it's more like that. I think they don't realize that they're taking away their students' agency sometimes. And taking away their ability to trust their own instincts. I think they just don't realize, they're just saying, no, it needs to be like this. And then they just model the teachers that they had, say, well, I'm the teacher and this is the way it should be. And the student says, well, what if I want to do it like this? Actually, I remember when I was a kid, I went to this I had a regular teacher, and then this teacher, she would sometimes take me to the university that was close by to see another teacher who she thought was more qualified. And I remember this teacher that she took me to told me to do something with the music that I thought I really didn't like. It was like, she said, I want you to play this part really soft and I really didn't like it. And I told when we got home, I said, I know she said to do this, but I don't really like it. She's like, well, too bad, you have to do it. And I was really annoyed by that at the time. I'm still annoyed, as you can see.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's good to be annoyed by things. Like, if they annoy you, you know, you just, you know, be annoyed. Be annoyed.
This is the first time I've said it right here on this podcast,
too. Wow. This is it right here. This is
like therapy for me.
Huh. Okay, let's see what else we can dig up. I don't think teachers are evil. I mean, I like to say that they're evil because I think it's humorous, and it's also, it's a way of validating my own well, my own anger and my own disappointment and frustration, and which I think needs to happen. I mean, it needs to happen for me, and it needs to happen for people who are, let's say, where I was 10 years ago. Like, they need to be validated so that they can learn to trust themselves and to know that their teachers are not, you know, their teachers are doing what they think is right and what it, and it's not necessarily in the student's best interest. Mm-hmm. And like, that's, you know, you have to become your own teacher. Like, you're the coach. Like, you're your own coach. That's like, no one else cares as much as you do. Also, the teachers don't care as much as you do about you.
Yeah.
You know, you're with yourself 24 hours a day. They're not.
Yeah. Were you angry at the time this was happening to you, that you were being taught to not trust your own instincts? Or do you think retrospectively?
I was not angry the whole time, because, I mean, looking back on it now, I kind of have a way of looking at it. I was not angry because I was not taught to trust myself. Okay. So instead of being angry at the teacher, I might've been angry at myself. Okay. I might've said, you know, I'm doing it wrong. I'm not practicing enough. I'm not doing what the teacher said to do. I know better. I made a careless mistake. I should have known better. Those are the kinds of things I would have said for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then at some point started to get frustrated with the teacher. Like, okay, you're telling me to do this thing, but I don't know how to do it. I can't find a way to make it work, you know? And I would try really hard to get it to work, and then, you know, get frustrated with them for not being clear enough about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point I was like, oh, I see what's happening here. Like, I see that they don't know. Like, they don't know. Like, they don't understand me. Like, they're not really, like, they're talking about themselves. Like, they're saying what they're hearing, sure. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about their experiences and, you know, what they heard their teacher say, but they're not these infinitely wise, you know, beings that I kind of thought they were supposed to be.
Mm.
And that's that. At that point, it was like, well, okay, I need to be the teacher now.
Yeah.
Do you, and have, you know what? Yeah.
Well, and I was going to say, and I don't even know if it's really necessarily a deficiency on their part. It's just that they can't know you. They can't know. They can't know how you're experiencing the world. They can only know how they're experiencing it. So, like you said, the teacher can only say, this is what I hear. I hear this happening, and you hear it too. And they might not be able to solve, they might be able to give you some suggestions, but ultimately, yeah, you have to find, they can't do it for you. Yeah. And, I've gone through that same thing where, you know, a teacher will point out something I'm doing wrong. This was actually when I was old, you know, I remember kind of beating myself up about it, pointing out something that I was doing wrong week after week, and I knew it was wrong, and I tried to correct it, and then I would revert back to another way of doing it in the lessons, and I was afraid that my teacher was going to think that I was not taking seriously her suggestions, you know, and I remember telling her that, but she was wise, and she said, no, I get it. She says, I don't take it that way, but I don't think all teachers do. I think some teachers take it personally. I can see that on Facebook, you know, I'm like, why does the student refuse to play with a steady tempo? They just refuse to do it.
Refuse.
They're not refusing.
I've told them over and over again for the last 3 years. I've been saying this.
I think, is that the one with that was just posted? I think I saw.
Yeah, something. Yeah,
yeah. But I've seen a lot. That was just one example. Yeah, I've told them. How would you explain it? How do you explain how to keep a steady tempo?
How do you explain it? I always, every time they ask that question, how would you do it? What would you do? I want to say, what does it matter what I would do? Like, I'm not you. I don't know the student. Like, why are you asking what I would do? Like, that's.
But people answer the question though. They're like, this is what course. I would do.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah. You get 50, 100 replies, you know, within 20 minutes of, you know, what they would do at these long dissertations about, you know, all from all corners of the earth, like all totally different philosophies. I mean, what do you do with that information? Who, like, and the other thing, like, yeah, how would you explain it? How would you explain it? Like, I wouldn't explain it.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't, you know?
Yeah.
How to explain. Yeah. Don't, I'm going to get fired up here because there's so much to talk about.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, me too. Well, I mean, that's another reason, going back to what you've been saying, that's why I like recording, is because, you know, I really think that the human brain can solve a lot of these problems if you just give it enough time. And I think the main thing is just being aware of the problems, and then the student is going to want to, oops. I don't know how to stop that. It's not my computer. The brain will solve those problems if you just give it a chance to, but it's not going to be because somebody explained it to you. Like if you're not playing with a steady tempo, I'm not going to be able to explain to you how to play with a steady tempo. I could say, try it with a metronome and see if you're with the metronome. Then you'll know if you're not a steady tempo. And I could say, record yourself and listen. And can you tap your foot to it? Does it feel like it's steady, or does it feel like you couldn't dance to it? Mm-hmm. I do think that the human brain will figure that out, but teachers really want to intervene. And
yeah.
And I don't think they should as much as many of them do.
I think a lot of teachers, I mean, teachers feel very insecure because if the student is not performing well, the student is not learning, not progressing, it's going to reflect badly on the teacher. And not even like, yeah, there's the public image that the teacher wants to maintain, but it's also just, you know, as a human being, they want to feel competent. Like they want to feel like they're doing a good job. So, you know, there's that pressure there. But like the student, I think there's another pressure that students have too, that students want to hear from teachers. Like they want solutions. They want to know. I mean, I've noticed this teaching piano, that this has been an issue. When I started teaching piano, I was doing things. I mean, I've always been weird, okay? I've never been a normal person, and I, you know, never been a normal piano teacher, but I was kind of doing things basically the conventional way, you know? You kind of listen to the student, you point out the mistakes, and, you know, and as I started to become really aware of kind of how things work on a deeper level, I stopped doing that so much. And one problem that I was running into, and I'm not going to say that I have solved this problem, is that students are expecting, like they want to hear what to do. They want to know what they're doing wrong. They want the teacher to tell them what they're doing wrong. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this may depend on the student. Okay. Some people are perhaps better. I don't really remember how I was when I started. I think I was probably more willing to experiment on my own, because that's just what I do naturally anyway. Okay. I'm not really walking around looking for people to tell me what's wrong with what I do. That's not how I approach most things, which is why I tend to, for most things that I'm interested in, I'm interested in a lot of different things. I like to experiment and learn things. And sometimes people will look at me and say, well, Michael, how are you so talented at this and that? And I'm like, I'm not talented. I just don't have the OCD about it that you do, where you need somebody standing over your shoulder telling you what's wrong all the time. Like, you know, like, how do I know, you know, how do I know how to, you know, how do I know about computer programming? Like, yeah, okay, I have degrees in computer science, but I knew about programming before that because I just sat down and just kind of figured it out a little bit, you know? How do I know how to type Google searches to find information? Like, I don't know. I just kind of figured it out. And a lot of piano students don't do that because they're just, you know, maybe they only play the piano during their lesson. Maybe they only, you know, they're just trying to, they're not really owning it themselves. And I think teachers get frustrated when they have those kinds of students, because maybe the teacher thinks they're doing something wrong, and maybe they are, but there's sort of a weird dynamic there, where it's like you have a teacher who is concerned about their own level of competence, and you have a student that's concerned with pleasing the teacher, and nobody in the room is really into the music, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. The thing that you said is kind of interesting is you're saying that when you were little, you would just experiment, and you do that, and you do that now. And you weren't even worried about some, you weren't looking for some external validation that you're doing it right or wrong. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's probably how most of us start. I mean, now that I have a daughter, I watch her, and she's not, well, she is starting to check to see if she's doing something wrong, because I mean, there are certain things that we don't want her to play with that she gets into. And so she'll, and I think she knows kind of what those things are, but sometimes she'll just test the waters. Like, what happens if I touch this cord or something? Are mom and dad going to tell me to stop doing that? Mm-hmm. But I think naturally she would just go and touch everything that she saw that was interesting. She'd put everything in her mouth that looks interesting. And we have a keyboard, and she goes and she just starts pushing buttons and playing random notes. And I don't think she's thinking about doing it right or wrong. So, I mean, I think we're taught that to start think, oh, I need to make sure that what I'm doing is okay. And we're especially taught it in music. And I think from my experience teaching, it's better if a student's parents don't do music at all. If the parents are at home, like, trying to help their kids, I think they're kind of depriving their kids of a chance to just, you know, mess around on the piano. And maybe, like, I remember hearing the story about Billy Joel. He would go and, like, he was learning Mozart piece. I don't even know if it's a true story. He might have exaggerated, but I think it's probably partially true. He would be in his piano lessons, he'd be learning a piece by Mozart. Instead of learning the piece that he was supposed to, he would improvise a piece kind of that sounded like Mozart. And his mom would say, that's really good. And then the next day he would improvise. She'd say, play that one again. But he didn't know what he played. So he'd play a different piece that sounded kind of like Mozart. And, you know, it's better if your if the parents are just letting the student do their thing. But I had a student when I was, this is a long time ago, was a little kid, and one day after or during his lesson, he said, it kind of seems like the lessons go like this. I play and you just tell me all the things I did wrong. And it kind of made me feel bad. I was like, oh, I'm not saying you're doing a bad job, but that really made me think. And he's like, is that all piano lessons are? Is you just telling me everything I did wrong? It's like 7 years old.
Well, they learn, you know, this is, they learn it from school, that when the teacher is talking about you, that they're telling you what you're doing wrong. So it's like, even if you didn't do that as the teacher, like, even if you're not the one who kind of established that pattern, like, they're mm-hmm. coming to that with that frame already mm-hmm. established. And so they're kind of interpreting your behavior. So you have to pay the price for all the other teachers that they've had in the past. And when they're seven, that's maybe a smaller price. When they're in college, that's a bigger price. And
And their parents too. You pay the price of their parents, their teachers, all the authority figures. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You said something interesting I was going to go back to about, I've run into that same thing about teaching students and kind of trying to take that approach of just a non-interventionist, I guess, approach to teaching piano. Maybe that's what I should call it. and then students, students are, they have to adjust to that. They're not used to that. And they don't like, some of them don't like it. They want you to rip them apart sometimes. And, I don't know. It's kind of this is why I think teaching is kind of an art, because, I've started doing it at some point is I try to make sure that the student knows that I hear what's going on, that I'm not oblivious to their errors and their mistakes, but I also don't want them to be overly concerned with those things. So I kind of have to prove, I think I have to gain their trust a little bit by saying, yeah, I hear that you made a mistake there. I hear that you screwed that up. But it's okay, you know, that's sort of, but I'm like you, I don't feel like I've solved the problem of here's how you teach piano.
Right. Yeah. Well, you want them to know that you're there. You want them to know that you're not, that you care about what's happening, that you're not just, you know, leaving them to their own devices, you know?
Yeah.
Like I had an interesting piano lesson that I was teaching once where I think at some point I was like, I was, you know, this worked really well. And I don't know, I'm not teaching piano much these days. Okay. So this was sort of, I haven't had a lot of time to experiment with piano teaching with doing it this way. Cause this was towards the end of when I was doing that more. Yeah. And what I did in this lesson was the student played something and she was asking me, you know, kind of looking at me for my feedback, for my corrections. And I was, and I said, well, do you think, like, okay, you tell me what was wrong with it. And she told me something that was wrong with it. Okay. And mm-hmm. I said, okay, so play it again. And then she played it again. And I said, okay, was there still that problem? Was it still there? Yes, it was. Okay. So play it again. And she played it again. Was that problem still there? No, it wasn't. Okay. So what was wrong with it this time? And she told me something else. So I said, okay, play it again. And we did this for an entire hour. and it was like at some point she realized like we kind of laughed about it. Like, I'm not saying anything. Like, this is not, like, I could just be a robot. Like, I don't know anything.
That's right. You could program a computer to teach piano that way.
Uh-huh.
But
yeah.
But no, that, I mean, that's, I think that's great that you did that, because I think, hopefully she took away from it that, you know, she went away from that feeling a little bit empowered, like, oh, I could actually fix a lot of things on my own.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I assume was that you were thinking. And I hope I hope that's what you took away from it. It's hard to know though. Like it's hard to know what they take away, because what you said, I mean, I wasn't there, but, she could have also said, oh, Michael doesn't know anything. And so mm-hmm. you know, that, but on the other hand, I mean, would that be so bad? So I've got I have this weird idea. It's like, sometimes I think my role as a teacher is to just protect them from the other teachers.
yeah. Right.
I don't know if that, does that make any sense? Like,
oh yeah,
like,
absolutely.
Like I'll keep them. If they study with me, then I'll give them room to grow, and I'll teach them to be empowered, and they won't. And you know, if they're studying with me, then they won't be, they're out of reach of the other teachers, you know?
But, yeah. It's funny that you say that, like, cause that was when I started teaching piano, I didn't have confidence that I was qualified to teach piano. Okay. Like, and I was kind of nervous to do that, and nervous to call myself a piano teacher, cause I didn't have any experience teaching piano. Well, very little really. And, you know, but I was going to start taking on students and asking for money, and like, but there was a sort of thought that went through my mind of like, well, even if I'm a bad teacher, like there are teachers that are worse. Okay. There are people that are really going to be a problem for you. And like, I am like, it's better to be with me than with one of them. So,
yeah. Yeah. I think that's true. And I mean, I felt that way too about, different students, whereas like, yeah, I mean, it's like because there are definitely teachers out there that are more accomplished pianists than I am, and probably know more repertoire, and probably student. You know, I mean, I have students that come in and they are working on pieces that I definitely can't sit down and just sight read them. But I know there are teachers out there. I've had some teachers that can kind of seem to sight read everything, and but I've had others that are more like me. You know that. But I feel like, I can still help those students, and I can keep them away from the ones that maybe will abuse them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there are a lot of teachers. I don't think you and I are totally unique. I mean, I think there are other teachers that think like this out there, mm-hmm. but I think there are others that are really concerned about, you know, about how the student is going to make me look. And, you know, I only want to have good students because I want to be seen as a good teacher, and I can't let my student play in public representing me playing poorly. And I think all that stuff is bad, you know. Yeah. I have been, and you know, teachers teach each other to be bad teachers, you know, by reinforcing stuff like that. Like, I had a student play badly one time, and some other teacher said, "Why did you let them play? You shouldn't have even let them play." I was like, "It's their, they have the right to play badly."
Do you think that there is a place for, because like, if you as a teacher want, like, if that's the kind of thing, like, if you want to be the kind of teacher where my students win competitions, okay, because you want to attract students who want to win competitions, because there's a market for that, right? There are students who want to win competitions, so they want to study with the teacher who's going to get them to that level. And so, so those teachers, for marketing purposes, are going to be, like, it, it makes sense for them to reject students who will not win competitions, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, so how does it happen? Because, okay, so, so if you look at it that way, then it seems to stand to reason. Like, it seems to make sense to say that, that a teacher, you know, should be like, this is how we do it here. Like, I'm not going to let you play if you're not at that level.
Hmm.
That, that seems to make sense. But at the same time, I also see this dynamic where it, I mean, it's kind of abusive. Like, you have a student who it does not want to win a competition, okay, but the teacher will at the same time not, like, they will act in a, in a way, you know, where they will want, they will say that the student can't play, for example. How does this happen? How does it happen where you have some teachers that will be, that will have high standards because that's the kind of teacher they are, and other teachers, they have this, it's something weird, okay, they sort of have high standards in air quotes here, but they, it's really some kind of weird abusive thing. It's how do we differentiate between those two situations?
Well, and the thing is, I think the teachers that are more like abusive, I think they have high standards. I think they think that's what they're doing. They think that's what's happening. They think, oh, I'm just, I have high standards. I, you know, I want, I just care about the music being good. So it's kind of like, you know, like dealing with a narcissist. I mean, you can't really convince them that what they're doing is, that there's anything wrong with what they're doing. You know, because there's, but yeah, I mean, I guess if some I've come across a few teachers who are, who that's what they do. Like, I put students in competitions and my students win. And so it makes sense that they're going to want to only take those students that are going to win competitions. But yeah, if you get stuck with one of those teachers and you don't want to go down that road, then things are going to be difficult for everybody.
Like, it seemed to me that, like, from the point of view of ethics, like, that if a teacher who is win, who has, is trying to produce competition winners, if that teacher is, comes across a prospective student who doesn't want that, then the teacher should say, like, oh, this probably isn't for you. Like, you should probably go study with a different teacher who's, cause I about winning competitions. That's what we do here.
Yeah.
But so it must be that these teachers, that there are teachers who want to win competitions, who are accepting students who don't have similar values, right?
Yeah. Well, I actually know a teacher that I really respect who does the opposite. This teacher, and I've known others like this too, but this teacher, she tells them right up front, you know, I don't do competitions. I don't put my students in competitions. If you want to win competitions, go study with somebody else. And I don't, I don't teach pieces, you know, I teach, you'll play a whole bunch of different pieces. I'm not going to spend a year teaching you how to play Moonlight Sonata, you know, and she tells them that up front because that's what some students want. So I think if the teachers first of all, can realize what they are and communicate to the students. I mean, I guess it's fine if there's, I mean, I have known students who want to win competitions. I've had students leave me because they want to do more competitions and go to a teacher that's going to put them in more competitions. And that's probably for the best, because I just didn't want to go. I haven't really wanted to go down that road. And I do enjoy like helping a student get to a high level, like especially if they're motivated to do that. And once in a while, I have a student who really wants like to play really well at the recital, and we'll go through their music with a fine tooth comb. And I think that's fun if the student's into it, but not so much to win a competition. Because I've done some adjudicating, and I know how arbitrary it is. I mean, maybe people won't admit it, but you know, if you hear five good pianists and you have to pick the best one, there's so many different factors. There's no way you can do it objectively. To an extent, there's some things that are objective, but it's going to come down to like, do you like the repertoire better? Do you think that the person? You're going to be influenced by how the person looks. Do they look like they're confident or not? I mean, it's going to be really subjective. So that's why I kind of hate those competitions.
Like for me, I'm not into competitions. Like I never won any competitions or anything. So for me, it's like, you know, it's not the culture that I'm from. It's not, I don't quite get it. I don't get why you'd want to do it. Okay. I had, you know, would leave open the possibility that maybe it is right for some people. Mm. It could, you know, I'm not saying that competitiveness overall is always a bad thing. I guess there are times where I like to be competitive, you know. Sometimes it can be fun, you know. And I think piano teachers don't, like, the idea of, like, I'm a certain kind of teacher and this is right, like this is how I do it. There's other kinds of teachers who do it differently. Like that's an idea that is lacking in music teaching. The idea that there's more than one way to do it, and because piano teachers are always like, there's this idea that, you know, there's good teachers and there's bad teachers. Like it's this continuum. It's like this one dimensional thing. You know, you're either good or bad or somewhere in the middle. And you know what I've learned from marketing is that there's something that's right for me might not be right for you. And it's my job, if I'm providing a service like piano teaching, it's my job to get clear on what it is that I'm offering and try to communicate that to you so that the people who are looking for that will be able to find me.
Yeah.
And competitions, there has been, a lot of teachers get really worked up about this. And because you see things like, I'm a teacher, I teach all levels, I teach all ages, I teach all styles, you know, I'll do anything. Okay. And that's the way most piano teachers are marketing themselves.
Yeah.
I have, and if you can't do that, right? So if you're a piano teacher who cannot teach somebody to win competitions, then you might feel deficient. You might feel like there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
Like, and so for me, there's been a lot of relief. Okay. In seeing like, you know what? I've never won a competition. Okay. So I'm not going to claim to teach you how to win a competition. Do I think I could teach you that? I don't know. Maybe, but like I'm not putting that on my business card. Like, I'm going to teach you how to win a competition, you know?
Right. Yeah. 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 It's true though. I mean, it's probably has a lot to do with economics. Teachers kind of say, oh, I can do anything. I can teach jazz. I can teach classical. I can teach composition. I can teach art, and you can win competitions or you can just play for fun. But, but there's going to be an area that you're going to gravitate towards. And yeah. And you know, at one point you were talking about the hierarchy. I think there's probably a hierarchy of piano teachers too. And probably the piano teachers that have students who win competitions are at the top of the hierarchy. And the thing is, it's not cool. I think most teachers know it's not cool to act like you're focused on winning competitions, but I think you can still tell that some of them are.
Yeah.
you know, it's kind of, you're supposed to be like, well, I just want them to have a great experience and learn to love music. But it's rare that a teacher's like, I just want my students to go out there and win and make me look good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think most teachers know that that sounds kind of repulsive, I think, to a lot of people.
Well, see, yeah, right. They do. And that's, I don't like that. Like, I don't like how they don't know. Like, I don't like how they, there's some kind of cognitive dissonance there. There's some kind of like, the language is confusing because they'll do that. You'll have teachers that are clearly, they care about the competitions, but they won't say it. They won't say it out loud. And that's toxic, in my opinion. Like claim it. Like, if you're about competitions, then say it. No, this is about competitions. That's what I'm going to do. Is it to make me look better? Of course. Like, I want success, you know? Like, I want my work to be successful. Okay?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It seems to me that this, being open about it kind of neutralizes the dangers of it.
Yeah, it's not the thing. Yeah, it's not repulsive if they're honest about it. I remember I played in, haven't done a ton of competitions, but it was just a few here and there. But I did one competition once, and the person who won, I didn't win, but the person who won, their teacher came up to me like a few months later. I ran into that person's teacher, and the teacher said, you know, I actually thought you played better than my student. And I always thought, oh, that he's going to win. But you know what? I'm glad that my student wins, because I just want my students. I love it when my students win competition. So and he was kind of joking about it, but not really. And he was a real nice, I mean, it was a real nice guy, but I just thought that was kind of interesting. He just was like, really honest about it, you know. He said, I thought you played better, but I was glad that my student won, because that's better for me and my student. So, and that's kind of disarming, and then you know where that person's coming from. Like, he wants to win competitions. But yeah, if it's when it's kind of, when it's obviously there, but they pretend like it's not, maybe that's the toxic part, I think.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's how they end up with students that don't, you know, if you're a teacher who wants to win a competition, but you say, no, it's just for fun, it's just so that you enjoy what you're doing, you're going to attract students who are looking to enjoy themselves, to have fun, whatever. And then that's where it gets weird. Cause then when the student fails to win the competition, the teacher gets, you know, it's very weird about it. I don't know of a better word. I'm just going to say weird. I mean, it gets convoluted.
Yeah. And again, that's why I'm kind of on this thing recently about, like, let's just get rid of, you know, I teach at this university. It's like, let's get rid of the juries, because I think the juries, there's so much, I think it's about the teachers. I'm not saying like lower the standards. I mean, you can still have standards and you can still have higher standards, but like, I think the teachers want to check up on each other and see, like, are my students better than yours? Are your students better than mine? I think that's sort of the same dynamic because the thing is, like, I want my students to be able to, I want them to have the experience of playing poorly so they know what it's like. You know, I want them to be able to say, well, this piece is not really, it may not be performance ready, but we're going to go ahead and play it. By playing it, we'll get closer to performance ready. So we're just going to go ahead and play it anyway. And there's this pressure, like, you can't let your students do that, because then you're a bad teacher. You're a bad teacher if you let people see your students not at a polished level. And I think that's...
Can you just explain what a jury is for anybody who's listening who has not been to music school?
Oh, sure. Yeah. So at the end of each term, most music programs, if you're studying music performance, like if you're studying piano performance or any kind of performance, vocal performance, if you're taking lessons, usually at the end of the term, your final exam is what you call a jury. And a jury is just when you go and perform something for usually a panel. Like, if it's vocal juries, then all the voice teachers get together and they listen to you and they write comments and they give you a grade. you go and sing for them, and they write comments, and it's really a weird dynamic, or it's really weird situation, because, you know, you perform, they usually just say hello to you, and then their heads are buried in their books or on their laptops typing, and they don't normally clap, and when you're done, they just say thank you, and then you just leave, and it feels really strange, I think, to a lot of students. I remember the first time I did a jury, I was like, that felt really weird. That didn't feel like I was playing music for people. That felt like I was being evaluated, which is what it was. Yeah, that's what a jury is. And I would rather say, let's have a, you know, if you want to have some kind of like culminating experience, like let's put on a recital, or let's make some videos. I think, you know, music schools, maybe all higher education, it's hard to get people to change, because, you know, especially I remember, like, for my DMA, we had to do this oral exam, and I thought this was kind of cool. So I think a lot of times the oral exam is like, they can ask you anything about music and you just have to know everything. So go learn everything and then you'll have your oral exam. And we're going to ask you, you better know everything. We're going to ask you about Palestrina or Stravinsky, or we can ask you about jazz or whatever, and you just have to know it all. And so where I went to school, they said, well, that's kind of stupid because nobody knows it all. And so you're just like, you just have to, it's just a practice, you know, it's just an exercise in learning how to bullshit. So let's actually, let's do this differently. And you're going to come up with 20 topics that you have like a short presentation, then you can take questions on it afterwards. So we had 20 topics, and they'll pick a few, we don't do all 20, but they'll pick like four or five of them, and you're ready to do like a 10-15 minute little spiel about them, and then they can interrogate you about those topics. And I thought that was probably better than the other way, you know, because at least it gives you something to focus on, and nobody knows everything, so why even pretend, you know? And my point is that music programs, I think, are slow to change. They're like, well, I had to do this terrible thing, so you should have to do it also. And so I'm glad that the place that I went, they decided that was stupid, because just because they had to do it doesn't mean it was good.
You know? Yeah. I mean, juries, that's weird. I mean, even the name jury is like, you're going
so
to
legal. And, yeah, legal. That's right. you're going to go before a jury, and if you go before a jury, you're in trouble, right?
Right, right. I know.
You committed a crime. Innocent. That's right. Yeah. I never thought about it that way, but that's exactly what, I mean, the jury is like, you know, you really, the jury has their life, you has your life in their hands.
Right. I never had to play be a defendant in a jury too many times. It only happened a couple times because I only did a master's degree in music. So that's a 2-year program. So I think I had to do a jury. I don't remember how they did it. I had to do two recitals, and then I had to do a jury before each recital. And I think I think that's it. I think. So I think I only
good
did
for
two.
You. Lucky.
Yeah. Yeah. But I've played, you know, before the pandemic, I was accompanying in the voice department, and so I was doing voice juries every semester.
Oh, right.
So I've been through tons of these things, and. Mm. That it's the weirdest experience. I mean, there's it is, you know, because I hear what the teachers are talking about, you know, when there's no student in the room, and it's you know, it is about the teachers' reputations. They care about they care about how they're viewed by the other teachers. They care about, you know, and it's not comfortable. It's not a good environment. Like the teachers will criticize. I love it when they criticize the students of teachers who are not in the room. Like this, if the teacher is not there, then
yeah,
you know, you hear what they're saying. To be evaluated by a teacher who has not worked with you, has not spent any time with you, they don't know where you're coming from, they don't know where you want to go, they don't know anything. Okay, they're just a stranger.
Yeah,
like what use is their feedback?
Exactly. That's exactly right. I mean, I remember getting some flack from a teacher, another teacher, because one of my students or a couple of my students played badly. And the thing is, my students actually played well for them, considering, you know, what, you know, where they were when they started that piece, and it was progress for them. And so it was kind of like they don't have the context. They don't know what's good or bad. You know, they only know, like, I guess for Carnegie Hall, or, you know, maybe every jury is pretty bad. Most juries are probably pretty bad, but for a jury, especially if, you know, maybe it's their first jury, maybe they got really nervous, you know, like that might be just doing the jury is a big success, you know, just that they showed up and played it and started and ended and left and didn't cry, you know, that's their success. Yeah. Not that it's okay if they could cry if they want to, but again, yeah.
I can think of many examples where students prior to the jury could not get through a piece of music from beginning to end. And in the jury, they did, which to me was a huge, like, that was a big accomplishment. And yeah, you know, they're not, it wasn't great, okay, by some objective standard, but for them, that's like a 500% improvement. I mean, you know, like, they don't know that, so come on.
It kind of reminds me, because you've been doing these challenges, these yoga challenges, and I'm almost like, I can barely touch my knees or anything like that. And I said, I tried to do this thing for 10 minutes, and I was just seemed like forever, and I quit. And you're like, okay, just do it for 3 minutes then. You know, and that was, you know, if I do it for 3 minutes, then, like, for me, that's a big success. To like drag myself to do it for 3 minutes. And I think that's what you're talking about with these students. Like, yeah, to somebody who has done yoga, they might think, what a loser. That guy sucks at yoga, you know?
Right. But that's just the teacher's ego there. I mean, like, yeah, with you, like, I gave you this yoga challenge, right? To do this thing for 10 minutes. Okay. And then you came back and said, well, you know, I couldn't do it for 10 minutes. I quit after 3 minutes. It was too difficult. Okay. So I said, okay, great. So 3 minutes, like, let's see if we can get 3 minutes as being a thing. Okay. Where it's not that you're quitting after 3 minutes and failing. It's like you quit after 3 minutes and succeeding, because that's the task now.
Mm, yeah. So you change the goal, you change the goalpost to be something that's achievable, but maybe stretches you this much.
Right, right. Yeah. I mean, why would you set a goal for yourself that you're going to fail at? Like, the purpose of a goal is to motivate you to practice. Yeah. Like, so right. Goals should be things that you succeed at. Like, there shouldn't be like maybe a 5% chance of failure. Okay. But it shouldn't be like a goal is like something off in the distance where, you know, you have a 5% chance of reaching it. That means that you have a lack of imagination there. If you can't come up with something that's a little bit closer to where you are.
And for some students, just showing up to the jury and starting and ending their piece is a huge success. And that's why I think for some students, like, just playing part of their piece, or just playing their piece at all, or just telling people that they're working on a piece is a success, you know, because they're too afraid to let people know that they're trying to play this piece, or, you know, putting your students in the position where they have to present like a polished performance at the end of each term, I think is a recipe for, you know, basically putting every student in that same box, saying everybody has to do yoga for 30 minutes every day. If you don't, then you're out of here.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense, because not everybody is there for the same reason. They're not carbon copies of each other. If they admitted students into the program who were all at the same level and who were likely to be able to do that, then sure, like, have the same standard. But that's not what they're doing at these music departments. Yeah. They're taking in students of all levels and all abilities and putting them all into the same box. And that just doesn't make any sense to me.
And the great thing about being able to offer like individualized instruction is that you can do that. I mean, that's the whole reason that we have it. If it were going to hold everyone to the exact same standard, then we should just teach it as a big class that everybody has to meet this goal. But if you teach individual, if it's an individual one-on-one situation, then you can tailor the goals to each student. But anyway,
right, you've been. you know, I'm into meditation and you've been doing some meditation.
Yeah.
Like, I'm curious to know about your experiences when it comes to music practice. Like, to me, there's so many connections here. You posted a video the other day, last week or something, where you had some kind of realization about what meditation was can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. Let's see if I can, I know which video you're talking about. I think that's where I said, I think meditation, you know, for a long time, I thought meditation was something kind of, you know, like some spiritual, kind of weird stuff. But I think at least the way that I'm starting to understand it is it's more about just getting out of your own mind's way and it's like we were talking about earlier, like letting your brain collect all the data about what's going on with yourself and then letting your brain process all those things on its own without your intervention. I think that's sort of how I was trying to describe it. And I just posted, I said, I think this is what meditation is. Am I on the right track? I think I've heard a lot of people talk about meditation in a way that sounds a lot more, I don't know, just goofy to me, but that actually makes sense. I mean, I really do believe that our brains are pretty powerful and they can do a lot of things, especially if we stay out of our own way. So I think that's what I was trying to say.
A lot of people, when they start meditating, they do it so that, because maybe they have anxiety, they have something like some stress, they want to kind of calm down, they want to relax, they want to, you know, somehow feel better. And
yeah.
Like, sure, but like the meditation as a practice, as a process, is not about relaxing. It's about kind of opening yourself up to what's going on around you so that your brain can synthesize all of that data and kind of come up with a more accurate model of how the world works, so that, you know, your life is going to be better because of that, because you're going to have more. You're going to have more wisdom. You're going to know what works and what doesn't in certain situations, and then you're going to get yourself into trouble less often. It's hard for people to understand that if they haven't done it, I think. Mm. And especially when they have this concept that it's about relaxing. And when you look at people who are meditating, they look like they're relaxed. They look like they're trying to chill out, zone out.
Mm-hmm.
Music students, I think, would benefit from meditation because this is the same processes that are involved when you're practicing. But I think if you suggest meditation to a lot of music students, they're going to immediately think of it only as a way to reduce performance anxiety. I'm curious, has your practicing changed since you've started meditating?
I think it has a little bit. I also think, I think it has a little bit, because I think in a way I was practicing, like when people would talk about meditation, I felt like I sort of related to what they were saying sometimes, even though because of practicing, you know, because it's like, it's about like being aware of everything that's happening and like just being super aware of what's going on in the case of practicing, like what's going on with your body, what's going on with the sounds that you're making. But I think I didn't really think of that as meditation until recently. But I think of it as like, I think I'm just a little bit more conscious that in a way when I'm practicing, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to do the same thing that people are trying to do when they meditate, which is pay more attention to everything that's happening and, you know, be as honest as possible, you know, with about what's actually happening and try to be aware of when I'm making assumptions or when I'm like maybe putting limitations on myself, like just try to become aware of those limitations that I'm putting on myself and questioning whether those limitations need to even be there. That's sort of how I think about practicing. It's like, for example, I think, okay, this is what I need to do. I need, this needs to sound this way. Well, what if it's, Does it have to sound that way? Could it sound a different way? Or I have to move a certain way. But maybe I don't. I just trying to just pay attention to what's happening at the moment and solve the problems, and kind of forget about, try not to let the assumptions and stories that I'm telling myself, try to get those out of the way and pay attention to what actually is. Mm-hmm. Am I making any sense here? I think
yeah.
I am.
Yeah, I think yeah. so. Can you give an example? Like, some people might say that this sounds good when it comes to jazz improvisation, you know, kind of being open to taking different directions. But if you're doing classical music and you're looking for a very specific result, like how would you explain it in those terms?
I think classical playing, you know, when you're trying to play another composer's music and you're trying to render what they've written on the score as accurately as possible, and you're trying to, I think you have to approach it like it's improvisation, even though you're playing the same notes. I mean, actually, you know, there was a point when I realized that in performance, like, I can respond to what's actually happening in the performance and do something more musical instead of trying to control it. I can, for example, I mean, just a really simple example is, like, let's say that I want to make a crescendo or something. And if I make the crescendo a little bit bigger than I expected, I think if I'm trying to control everything, I might back up and be like, oh, wait, no, that's too loud, too early. But if I'm just responding to the moment, I'd be like, I guess this is where it's going. I'll just follow where it's going, instead of trying to necessarily grab onto it and pull it back to where it needs to be. I actually think that that's a good way to approach classical music. There are limitations to what I'm saying, but I think there's a lot of truth. I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think you can actually have some spontaneity but you have to kind of train that. You have to, like, practice responding to the moment as you're playing, responding to the sounds that you're actually hearing, and adjusting in the moment, just like an improviser does.
Yeah. In classical music, you know, everything, there's a lot of stuff written on the page. Like, it tells you what notes to play, you know, what buttons to push. It tells you what, you know, where to get louder, where to get softer, where to go faster or slower.
Yeah.
And at first, you know, kind of taking piano lessons and going through kind of the normal way of learning piano, it was like, well, those are instructions I need to follow. And yeah, if let's say you're in the middle of a crescendo and it's like you suddenly realize you're doing it wrong, okay, better stop, better back off and change it. But it's like, yeah, I had this realization at some point that, you know, it is like improvisation. It's like I'm the composer. Okay, if I'm playing a piece by Mozart, I need to be the composer of this piece. And like, if I can't see this music in a way that I'm the one who wrote it, then it's not working. I'm just quoting. Like, I'm trying to just reproduce something. It's like,
yeah.
Yeah.
I think musicians should learn from actors and theater people sometimes. Like, because I think they seem to have a better attitude about this. You know, it's like, I think if an actor screws up a line, they still keep their character going, you know? They still stay in the scene. They still keep the same emotion. If they screw up their line, they'll improvise a line that's sort of like what they were trying to say, because the important thing is that they keep the scene going. And I think that's what musicians need to do. And I don't think that actors necessarily, I mean, I'm saying this as a person who's not an actor, okay? So I could be full of shit, but I don't think that they necessarily say the lines the same way every time, you know, and even though they're saying the same words. I think that's how we should approach it a little bit more. And I don't think we were really taught to do that. Yeah.
I'm not an actor, but I've read about acting and I have some interest in it, like from that perspective, that it's actors do understand this stuff better. Like, I mean, it's common sense. You'd think it would be common sense. Like if I'm playing the role of Abraham Lincoln giving the Gettysburg Address, like, and if I stop, you know, if I'm saying the wrong word, okay, or something, like I'm not going to stop in the middle and correct it. Like that makes zero sense. I don't know what Abraham Lincoln would have done. I don't know. I wasn't there. But look, if I'm playing a role where I'm a character, like it's not about the words. It's about what the character is trying to do. And if I'm trying to convince somebody of something, if I'm trying to whatever, like that's what I'm doing. Even if I make a mistake, it's like that can't be it because I'm the character. But music right. students don't look at it that way. They'll say, well, if I make a mistake, I need to correct the mistake right there in the middle of the performance, as if they get extra points for doing that. Like that. That messes up the performance because you've just come out of character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's worse than playing a wrong note.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, playing a wrong note is totally forgivable, but like stopping, breaking character is much worse, I think.
Yeah, it messes stopping the whole thing up. It's like the whole thing is ruined. You just
It takes us right out of the moment. And we remember, you know, we remember that you're doing something hard. And you've that you've practiced. We don't want to. We don't want to listen. Nobody wants to listen to that. I mean, some people do, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean it's the suspension of disbelief that gets shattered there. Like the audience wants to hear. Like they want to be in the music. They want to be. You know, they want to be tapping their foot along with it. And you just messed that up. Like, you know, it's not. And now we're suddenly aware. Oh, we're listening to somebody playing music. We're not.
Mm.
You know, it's not we're not absorbed in the music. It's like you're watching TV and you're absorbed in the TV show. And then suddenly there's, you know, there's static or the sound cuts out or something. And now, oh no, now I'm sitting here in my crappy life, just watching TV.
I came here because I wanted to forget about my crappy life and all of my problems. And now you're making me think about them again.
Yeah.
And I don't think actors do it. I think if the actors break character, I don't think they, probably bad actors do, but I don't think they don't break character if they screw up their lines. I think most of them
they're trained not to. They're trained they train to consider the character to be more important than the literal words on the page.
And I think actors, I was like in theater and stuff in high school a little bit, and I think actors are trained to improvise too. And so that they're ready to react to those moments. I mean, they're trained they do like theater games and stuff like that, don't they? I mean, somebody will tell somebody, maybe somebody will write in the comments that I don't know what I'm talking about, but I think it's true. I remember doing like games and stuff, that sort of train you to be present in the moment. And so that, you know, if something happens during the performance, you can adjust and make it work. But I don't know if a lot of musicians have never improvised a note in their life.
No, they don't. You're right about actors. Like I did an acting class a couple of years ago. It was just a 2-day class, and because I wanted to try out some of the stuff. And we did, that was a lot of what we did was those types of games where you just improvise, you know, in a group, you just have certain things. I don't even remember what they were. But it's those types of things where you'll just, as a group, you try to react to what the other person's doing and just try to make it work. And that musicians should do that. They don't do it. They don't do it. They'll be terrified if you tell them to improvise something. And, you know, it gets even worse when you have another person there too. If you're doing chamber music or, you know, anything like that, like it's just suddenly you have, you know, a group of people that are all obsessed over being exactly correct together, and then they start getting mad at each other when the other one screws up. It's like, come on, just like, look, I can't blame them because they don't practice this. They don't train this way. Okay.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You should train this way. Like if the other person screws up, okay, what are you going to do? You have to stay in character, like make it work somehow. It's not impossible.
Yeah. And because the thing is like, there are going to be these screw-ups. So for the acting class that you took, like, I mean, that's true even if it's like a Shakespearean actor or anything, right? It's not just, you know, like all actors have to learn how to do that, right?
I mean,
yeah, I would think. I don't, yeah, but
I mean, good ones are going to have to, yeah.
Yeah. And it reminds me, I always thought that classical, like you said something about chamber groups. I feel like this would be good for chamber music's chamber groups to do. And I did this in a jazz combo once. The guy, there was a coach, and he had this, we were doing, playing some like 12 bar blues and or something like that. And he said, okay, every four bars, so you're gonna play for four bars, just play whatever, you know, play the blues. And then the next four bars, I just want complete chaos, just like clusters, no time, no rhythm, weird stuff on the piano, weird stuff on the bass. And then four bars back to normal. And then four bars of chaos, four bars back to normal. And that was such a cool exercise because we still had to keep track of the time, mm-hmm. you know. I always wanted to do, and I've tried this a little bit with students, but I think it takes a while to get over this idea of like, now we're going to just intentionally screw things up and then try to make ourselves get back on track. Mm-hmm. But I haven't coached a lot of chamber groups, especially not recently, but if I did, I think I would come up with some kind of exercises like that where they, so they can deal with, like, you know, if, let's say that the pianist screws up, turns two pages and plays, you know, two or three mystery measures while they find their place. Like the other musicians can't stop.
Right. Classical musicians will freak out when that happens, but you know, other musicians can deal with it because they practice that way and they don't take it that seriously. I've done a couple types of exercises that I find interesting, like with a choir. I've done like with my church choir, which we've done a thing where it's like if you have like the sopranos and the basses that are like, let's say the basses have to do something that's kind of reacting to what the sopranos are doing. Okay, that's how the music is written. Mm-hmm. Then I'll say, okay, this, like, I'm not going to conduct it. Okay. Like, I want the sopranos to, you kind of go at your own pace. Okay. Like, try to throw off the basses. Okay. Like, deliberately try to do it. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the basses have to react to what they're doing. So it's not just like, you know, you don't just come in when you think you're supposed to come in. Like, you have to make it work as a group. And that's always a little awkward at first, but then they kind of figure it out and everybody has a lot more fun doing that, you know, because they're not trying to follow directions. They're trying to actually make something.
That's really interesting, actually, because I'm kind of like you. I direct a choir too, not during the pandemic, of course. But correct me if I'm wrong, but I've taken some classes and stuff, but I don't really feel like I'm an expert at leading a choir. So I feel like a lot of it is just experimentation. But I've done some of those same things. I just kind of figured out that, remember we were doing something this has happened more than once. We were doing something in unison. And so I'm trying to conduct it, you know, and everyone's trying to stay with me, but they're fighting against each other. They're like, no, no, it's here. No, it's here. And I realize it's better if I don't conduct because they're all interpreting things slightly different. I said, I'm just not going to conduct and we're going to stay together by listening to each other. And it works so much better. I realize I'm getting in their way by trying to connect. And they're not paying attention to what the singers around them are doing. So if I kind of force them to pay attention to the singers that around them, then they sing together, you know. But
yeah. There seems there's two different kinds of conducting. It's like one, it's like where you are like asserting on the group and trying to if the group is not doing what you want, then you try to just kind of conduct louder and louder, mm-hmm. and or you can kind of go with it. And it's I'm not a trained conductor in that sense. I mean, I've just experimented on my own, and I found it very interesting to play around with this. And because a group has, like, they kind of have their own energy, and sometimes when the group synchronizes with itself, but they're not synchronized with me, I have found that it seems that it's better to respect that and not to try to mess that up, okay, but to go with it and maybe try to influence it if I can, but don't get in the way of it. I was playing a piano during a choir concert with a large group and they're a very good choir and a good conductor, and I was finding it was difficult there was like a band also, and it was loud. And like, this was a learning experience for me, I think, and I will not make this mistake again, where I was trying to follow the conductor. Okay. But the choir was not following the conductor. Okay. And after this happened, okay, somebody came up to me who was like a black gospel pianist, like, you know, really kind of grew up in that culture of the kind of music that I was playing. Okay.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, asking me if I was able to hear okay, if I could hear the choir.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, I heard the choir. I was trying to follow the conductor, you know, because that's what the conductor had told me to do. And, and I was like, no, you know, that was a mistake. Like that, when that happens, what the audience hears is that the pianist is on another planet. Like that's what happens.
I know exactly. Yeah. I've had experiences like that. And that's, yeah, it's better not to follow the conductor in that situation. Don't tell the conductor, but you know, actually I've heard, so, I'm not an expert at all at directing choir. I mean, I've got some experience, but I don't think of myself as an expert, but I know some people are pretty good at it. And they've said some of the same things. Like the one of the guys he's kind of like my mentor as far as choir goes. But he's told me that it's a constant negotiation. I mean, you might be, like you said, trying to influence them a little bit, but if they're finding a groove without you, then you should just go with it, because that's going to sound better than trying to impose what you think it should be in your brain. Is if they find their own groove, then I'm all for that.
Yeah. Another thing I've done with solo piano is like practicing from memory. I played around a lot with this. I came up with all these exercises. I got very obsessed at some point with trying to figure out how can I memorize something spending the least amount of time looking at the score. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I was experimenting a lot with was I will put the score away. I'll start playing. And like the rule is like, I have to finish the piece. Okay. So like I've been doing a Bach prelude and it's like, okay, I'll look at the score. Okay. I kind of like, I've heard it before. I kind of know how it goes. Okay. Look at it. Okay. Put it away. Maybe I play the first measure, right? Okay. Now my job is to finish the piece.
Mm-hmm.
Like however I get to the end. And I spent many hours doing this and like, I don't know in terms of efficiency, like, I don't know, I haven't worked it all out, but one thing that happens is that it gets to a point where, I mean, first of all, you have this sense of owning the music. Like I'm playing music. I'm not trying to recall something from memory. Like I'm playing, you know, and that's like, I haven't practiced the piano a lot lately, but there's, people should do that. You know, that's my position, whatever. I don't know how to finish this sentence.
So, let's say you only had the first measure in your brain, when you say finish the piece, so you just kind of make up the rest of the piece?
Well, however you do it, you know, you have to look, it has to have a beginning and an end. You know, you can't just stop and say, oh, I forgot what comes next. And if that means I play one measure and then I find some kind of resolution and end it right there, fine. If it means that maybe I remember how the ending goes. Okay. Maybe I'll skip to the ending and make it work somehow. Okay. Mm-hmm. But somehow or another, it's like the rule is only, you have to make it, let's say for somebody who didn't know the music, like they would have to hear it as a piece of music and not as somebody struggling to get through.
That's what I was wondering. So like you play something that resembles the piece as close as as much as you can remember, but it still sounds like a piece of music.
Yep.
Yeah.
Always has to sound like a piece of music.
Maybe I'll try that. I'll try that and see what happens, because that sounds kind of interesting.
Yeah. Try it. It will teach you a lot about yourself, I think.
Yeah. I don't spend a lot of time consciously thinking about memorizing music. Especially not lately. I guess I probably did when I was more on deadlines, but I do a lot of like just trying to understand the music. And then I find that once I really understand it, then it's memorized. You know, once I really understand, like, once I feel like I really understand, oh, okay, we're in this key, and then it goes to this chord, the melody does this, and then there's an interesting turn of events to get to this other key. Like, once I understand, like, have a map, then it's memorized. But I'm not, like, sitting there trying to memorize the piece. Mm-hmm. But it's slower. It's a little slower that way, I think.
Like, I'm such a good sight reader that I never really had an incentive to memorize unless I was forced to. So I don't have a lot of practice memorizing.
Yeah.
So I wanted to explore that. It's like, it's just, to me, it's like, I can play the piece, like, just, you know, it doesn't take a lot of practice to get to where I can play it, you know? And so,
yeah.
And which is a problem too. I mean, I have, on some level, yeah, it means that I don't have as deep of an understanding.
Mm-hmm.
But I also have a good understanding. I mean, I've gotten to a point where I can sight read things quickly. Like, I can get a good understanding very quickly.
Yeah.
But memory is it's something that intimidates me. And especially with something like Bach. I mean, that's scary.
I think I've kind of found, it kind of seems to be true that people that are good readers are often have trouble with memorizing. I kind of started out being a really crappy reader for some reason. I think I was playing by ear a lot, and I just didn't even realize it. Mm. I think I was kind of looking at the score, but I was mostly just like playing by ear. And then until I was in a situation, you know, I started playing for choir and stuff, and then I was like, oh, I suck at sight reading. So then I consciously started to get better at it. But it sort of seems like people that are like me kind of memorize easily. And then people that are just naturally good at reading seem to have, I mean, that's a stupid generalization. There are all kinds, but it sort of seems like that's a tendency, you know? Yeah,
I think so. I think there's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah.
Because it's like, that's what you, we spend time doing the things that we're good at. And so if you're good at, if you're good at playing by ear and you're good at then you're going to be good at memorizing because you're going to have, I don't know, you probably have a better understanding of what you're hearing than I do.
Yeah.
You probably have a better, I don't know. So that, whereas for me, I just think I'd probably look at it a little bit differently. And as a result, I specialize a little bit in a different way.
Yeah. Well, and I kind of have an affinity for harmony and chords and just analysis. You know, I like to look at the music and try to sort of take it apart in my mind and figure out, how did he get this from that, or how did they go from this to there, how does what holds the piece together. Mm-hmm. But you probably have that too. I mean, you probably have that kind of curiosity too.
Yeah, for me it's like the things, like when I think of a piece of music, like I think about the structure of it. Like, I don't think in terms of like the harmony, that's a subtler layer that's takes a little more effort for me to really get to. I think I think of it like a structure, like of a shape of some kind. Like, there's, you know, if it's like there's three parts to it, so then there's like one, two, three, and it's kind of thing. Hard to put this into words, but it's the people are have an easier time. Like, I don't know, because I don't think my brain works this way, but have an easier time thinking about, I don't know what it is about. I imagine it just being like the tension, the resolution of that tension, like that is what, like the modulations, whatever, is like, to me, that's like a subtler layer on the music. Do you get what I'm saying?
I think so. Are you kind of focused? Do you think you're focused on things like, all right, here's a phrase, and then here's another phrase,
right?
And then here's a really long phrase that kind of like phrase lengths and how one phrase relates to the next. Not necessarily
the way you might draw it or something, like not the way you're hearing it.
Yeah, like if you're going to make a map or like a
map, yeah,
like a yeah. And I guess I'm interested in that too. Yeah, I'm interested in all that stuff. I mean, it's never ending, and every piece is different. And
yeah,
I've been doing it for music theory, especially partly because it's remote. But I think I'll do this even when we're live. I'm doing a lot more composing. Like, all right, this is a rondo. Here's a rondo. So let's everyone go write a rondo. I don't want you to spend too long on it. Spend no more than an hour or two. Just write a rondo, just to show that you understand what a rondo is. You know, and I feel like that's more interesting than let's analyze this piece or let's spend a lot of time talking about this is the mental model in your head, because no piece really follows the models that we learn in form and analysis and stuff. Like, there's no, I don't think I've ever even, there probably is one somewhere, but like we learn about sonata form, and every single sonata I look at, it's like, well, this kind of actually deviates from that archetype. It's like, so what good is the archetype? You know, what good is the, I mean, I think so.
Right.
I don't know quite what I'm trying to say, but
yeah. Mm. Right. Well, yeah. I mean, there's the theory and there's the practice, and you know, the theory is only as good as the practice. Like, the point of theory is to explain what you're doing. It's to put words to something that you already kind of have an intuition about.
I liked what you were saying before about how we all know what tonic and dominant is, even though we don't know what they're called. But, you know, like a lot of that. Everybody has heard that, you know, everybody's heard all those things. This is like it's the same way that we all know grammar of our native language, even if we don't know grammar. We don't know the rules, but we all tend to, what was the thing? I've heard about this thing. I think was it you that posted this thing about how we put our adjectives in a certain order?
Right. I posted that. Yeah.
Isn't that fascinating? It's like, we always say a big red truck. We don't say a red big truck.
Right. There's a specific order to these adjectives. I don't remember the order, but it's like, there's like the, you say like a big red truck. So it's like the size has to come before the color.
But nobody ever taught me that. Did anyone ever teach you that?
I never heard that before. But apparently ESL students are taught this, and they stress out about it because they have to memorize this list. There's like nine different kinds of adjectives or something, and you have to know the order because it's very specific in English.
Is it different in different languages? Or I was wondering, because, you know, like there's this... Because, you know, I remember reading this little bit of Noam Chomsky talking about like the... There's this universal grammar or something like that. It was like every language.
Oh,
generative grammar or something like that.
Uh-huh. Well, he has like a language acquisition device in your brain. That's the idea.
Yeah, yeah. And it's the same, I mean, fundamentally, underneath the fundamental structure of grammar is more or less the same in every language.
Like, languages all evolved, like... They evolved from, like, there's a family tree of languages. So all of the European languages all have a common ancestor. So it stands to reason that there's going to be a lot of similarities in the grammar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Chomsky, I guess, would say, and I'm not an expert on this, but I guess Chomsky's idea is that there's something like biological about it. There's something neurological that's how our brain works. And that's how we, like, that languages have to work in that way. I don't know if that's settled or not, like, because it might just be languages have those commonalities because they all have a common ancestor.
It could be that, or it could be that there's something about the way our brains organize thoughts and information that that language flows out of that. Or it might be both those things. I don't know. I need to read more Noam Chomsky. I love to listen to his political stuff, but but he's really, that's you know, he's a linguist. I think that's his first thing.
I mean, I didn't know. I first heard about him in computer science because of the language stuff. He's very relevant in theoretical computer science, and I mean, that's really where it is, because talking about different kinds of grammars, you know, which you would use for programming languages or whatever, but there's a Chomsky hierarchy of languages, which is, this is, I don't know that anybody listening to this podcast is going to even find this interesting, but but that's, so I didn't know he was into politics at all until after I had already studied him.
All right. From that no, yeah. That's true. The very first time I took a real computer science class, I remember the teacher said something about Noam Chomsky, and I was like, oh, guys mm-hmm. everywhere. I first heard about him talking about politics, and then I learned he was a linguist. And
well, there's like the P versus NP problem. Are you familiar with that?
I don't remember this. What's that about?
Well, it's this famous unsolved problem in computer science, P versus NP. It's like, does P equal NP? Okay, this is...
Yeah. I do know that. That's like... don't tell me, because I think I took a test on this. All right, you can tell me, but I this is familiar now. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just to... It's without getting too technical about it, I mean, the like P is like, these are sets, they're classes of problems, okay? Problems that you might solve with an algorithm, okay? So like P would be the set of problems that would be solvable in polynomial time, okay? And NP is, okay, I don't know how to explain this without getting too technical, but, yeah. But I guess the really non-rigorous way of explaining it would be like P is the set of problems that you can solve quickly, and NP is the set of problems that you can verify the solution to quickly.
Right. Yeah.
Like an example, something like to, if you want to factor a number. Mm. So if I give you like a large number and I give you the factorization of it, the prime factorization. So the numbers that you would multiply together.
Yeah.
To get that number.
Yeah.
You could easily do the multiplication. Okay. It's easy to check if I'm right. You know, if I tell you, like if I give you the number, you know, 12, and I tell you that 2 times 2 times 3 equals 12, like you can easily verify that. Mm-hmm. But if I give you 12 and ask you to factor it, it seems to be harder. Okay. But we don't know if it's harder because, you know, maybe there's a quick way to do it that we don't know about yet.
I remember Noam Chomsky talking about some lecture I heard talking about chess, like teaching a computer to play chess. Mm. And he said it's kind of interesting because you can usually get a computer to beat a human in chess, most humans. Mm. But the way a computer thinks about chess is not at all the same way that a human being thinks about when they're playing chess. You know, and the same with factoring, you know, like when we if you said, what's the prime factorization of 12? I remember learning about how to do stuff like that. I kind of remember doing it in algebra. And I remember that there's a certain amount of intuition involved, isn't there? Mm-hmm. Like, so it's like sort of like a trial and error. And it's not necessarily you can't teach a computer to do that, I don't think.
The intuition's hard, yeah.
Yeah, the computer has to have like a process that you give it.
I mean, there's things like neural networks and stuff that you can kind of train the computer, you know, like
to learn
stuff. Yeah. Like, and then, you know, for like things like voice recognition or like the way they detect like credit card fraud, like we don't know how the computer does it. We don't know because it's trained with this, you know, so that's weird. You know,
that is really weird.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And things like, you know, people like you talk about social media, like the algorithms, like the Instagram algorithm or the Facebook algorithm that determines like what posts you're seeing. Like, you know, you can sit there and say that Instagram is like has a grudge against you, but I bet you that Instagram probably doesn't really know. Okay. Cause it's trained. Yeah. It's artificial intelligence that's learned somehow.
Well, and I think if I understand it right, I mean, like the algorithm that Instagram has is like, it has a specific objective. It's kind of like that thing that just came out of The Social Dilemma. Like the objective is to keep you on their app for as much time as possible. It's not necessarily trying, cause sometimes people say, oh, the racist YouTube algorithm or something like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure if that's how it works. I think it's just trying to keep you on YouTube.
Yeah.
And if I understand it right, like it, whatever the objective that they give these apps, like the computer learns how to do it and we might not even understand what they're doing.
Right.
I read this thing about the paperclip maximizer. Did I tell you about that?
No.
Somebody was talking about artificial intelligence. It's like, it's like a short story, but it's kind of a, it's like, we built this thing called the paper, this office was always running out of paper clips. So they built a paperclip maximizer, which makes sure that there's always plenty of paper clips. And we don't know how it works, but it just, that's its main thing. So it'll order paper clips for us. And when we run out, it knows when we run out. But then pretty soon it started kind of going overboard, just like all these pallets of paper clips showing up. And so they tried to we need to shut this down. And, but the algorithm realized that the human beings were actually in the way of it meeting its objective. This algorithm decided that it needs to kill all the humans in order to fulfill its objective to maximize paperclips. Mm-hmm. And it just, I thought that was kind of an interesting.
Well, that's why, they need to program in the laws of robotics that are, it's like, computers are not allowed to kill humans. You can't violate that rule no matter what happens.
That's right. No matter what happens, this is your first, that has to be part of their instructions. Yeah. They have to remember that. They can't be they probably should be some other rules too, but that should definitely be one of them.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking for about 2 hours now.
Oh, yikes. That was fun though.
Time. Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
Anything else we wanted to cover?
I think there's a lot. I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything embarrassing, did I?
I guess we'll find out when feedback out. And somebody says,
No, that was fun. That was fun to chat. Actually, the way I've interacted with you before has always been usually one sentence at a time. Here and there, or I see one video. So it's kind of nice to kind of flesh out some of these things that you and I have sort of talked about in more like a social media kind of a way. Mm-hmm. But it's fun to actually have a conversation in person.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. I tried to bring it back around. We're talking about being in person.
All the way back around. It's all a circle. It's all connected anyway.
Yeah.
Thank you, David.
Thank you. I'm not very good at ending conversations.
Yeah, I don't know. Let's just end it. We'll end it. This is the end of the podcast here. And then.
Thus endeth the podcast.
Thus endeth the podcast.
All right. Thanks for listening. Please rate or review this podcast. Really, it would be great if you did that. It would be. Do it, please. For me. For yourself. Do it. Okay. Talk to you next time.